Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And as usual, in the great wide world of food, drink, and travel, there's something going on. Something big is happening soon.
There's always something going on.
There's always something. Yeah, I mean, there are food festivals. If you ever Google that, you'll find they're in the millions all over the world. Every day.
but one of the biggest hoo-has is certainly the world's 50 best restaurant awards, which we've been attending for several years, and
since London, many years actually.
Will Drew and his brother and their organization has been sponsoring it now for 16 years, and this year, curiously enough, they're going to finish up in the northeastern part of Spain, in what a number of people, I guess, would call one of the world's culinary capitals.
Basque country. Good eats. Good.
Okay, so here's our good friend Will with the story of World's 50 Best Restaurants for 2018.
Right.
Coming right up.
Will Drew, here we are again. What number is this of the World's Best Restaurant events?
Well, this is the 16th year of the World's 50 Best Restaurants, so I haven't been there for that whole period, but it's certainly been a number of years
Start with the basics here. You know, like we learned in journalism class, who, what, where, why, when.
Sure. So it started in 2002 just as a feature in a magazine, and has built over the last 16 years into what we believe is to be the most important gastronomic gathering of chefs and restaurateurs in the world, as well as the most important list for international diners who want to travel internationally. The award ceremony this year is taking place on June the 19th in Bilbao, in the Basque country of Spain. After a number of years of hosting it in London in 2016, we started to move it around the world, and we did it in 2016 in New York, and then last year, 2017, in Melbourne, Australia.
Which was spectacular, by the way.
Thank you very much. Well, the Australian public and food and drink community really embraced 50 Best and welcomed all the chefs from around the world, and very excited to have them there and showcased Australian food and drink to a fantastic degree.
Well, we've pummeled listeners. We have pummeled Will up and down 8 times from nothing, and he won't reveal where it's going to be in 2019.
Sure. I mean, we want to focus on 2018 and the amazing event program that we're putting together for those 4 or 5 days in June. Once the dust has settled on that, then we'll be prepared to talk about 2019. But we don't want to talk about 2019 because our focus is all about 2018 at the moment.
Okay. Now, you've already released some information. The outstanding woman chef, Claire Smith, is it?
That's right. Yeah. So the UK's Claire Smith recently been named the Elite Booker World's Best Female Chef, which is very exciting for the London restaurant scene, and you know, she's growing her name internationally for sure. Opened her own restaurant last year for the first time.
And she put up with Gordon Ramsay all those years.
Yeah, she was more than put out with him. She worked with him for 13 years, so I think she stood up to him extremely well. But now she's doing her own thing, which is, you know, an important step for her, and being incredibly successful as that. We also announced the Diners Club Lifetime Achievement Award, which went to Gaston Acurio from Peru this year. And then next week we will announce the Mila One to Watch for a restaurant that's outside of the 50, but there's a rising star.
Now, you do...
By way of interest, by the way, Will, while we are in Spain, we're going on from the Basque country to Barcelona, and one of our ports of call is last year's One to Watch.
Sure. Which won last year's Mila One to Watch. Yeah, it's an extraordinary restaurant. I'm lucky enough to have been there myself, and I have to say it's a really outstanding experience with lots of reminiscences from El Bulli, where the three chefs
right, exactly.
Behind it met and came from, and the influence is very palpable, but it's also doing its own thing. It's taking things on, you know, from the El Bulli model in a lovely space in Barcelona. That's definitely worth a visit.
You know, it seems like a gazillion years ago. We went to El Bulli in 2000. I guess it is a gazillion years ago.
Yeah.
It was all very new at the time, you know. I mean, now
sure.
I guess there's more widespread. So you do the world's 50 best, the world. Then you do the world's 50 best in
Asia.
Then you do the world's 50 best in Latin America, which has become very, very big, actually. Who knew, huh?
Sure. So, from 2013, both Asia's 50 best restaurants and Latin America's 50 best restaurants have been a key part of our portfolio.
I have to insert something funny, however, is a few years ago, I was talking at one of the receptions to Thomas Keller, and he said, watch out, the next is going to be the 50 best restaurants in Puerto Rico. This was before we had any of this trauma in Puerto Rico.
So that turns out to be a very bad joke.
Exactly, it turned out to be a bad joke. Okay, now let's go back to what all is encompassed in this program, followed by who are these judges? Oh, no, not that. We'll do the program first. What all happens?
Sure. So, okay. So
besides eating, great. I mean, we eat so superbly. Okay. And in the Basque country, that's a given.
Absolutely, and that's a very important part of it. And not even being flippant, because we're bringing people, whether they be chefs or restaurateurs or media, who are interested or in gastronomy. We bring them from all around the world to the destination, the host destination, in this case the Basque Country. And of course people want to eat and drink well together, so that's vital. And in that respect, having been out of Europe for a couple of years in New York and then in Australia, bringing 50 Best back into Europe is exciting to ring the changes, if you like, and also to go to one of Europe's most celebrated gastronomic areas, the Basque Country of Spain, which is known for its superb food and drink, and for the culture that embraces hospitality and food and drink as kind of as a core part of its culture.
You're going to have an event in Bilbao at the Guggenheim.
Yeah, sure. So, number of events going on in the area, including in Bilbao and in San Sebastian. We're going to have a 50 Best Talks event on Sunday, 17th of June, in San Sebastian, with some of the world's best chefs coming together to discuss key issues of the day on the theme of the life cycle of food and restaurants. We're going to have an event at the Guggenheim Museum called Food Meets Art, where we have leading chefs and artists discussing together the creative process and how the two disciplines can feed off each other.
Yeah, there's a woman in New Orleans that does she's a restaurateur, and she does, when they have a major exhibition at the museum, the art museum, she does a menu to match it. She did one with the Impressionists, I remember. And as I mentioned to you before, I mean, half of us in the food world actually started out as artists or art historians. It's a very close discipline.
I think the kind of cross pollination between the two areas is really strong, and something that's kind of evident in terms of the artistic nature of the dishes that many of these chefs produce, and just the nature of creativity and expression, and you can do that through food or through art. I think it's certainly an area that's ripe for further discussion, and because we're in Bilbao, the Guggenheim is such an iconic space, an iconic building, and that seems a great it's a great opportunity to do something there that, that marries food and art. And then we'll have a traditional chef's feast the evening before the awards.
Yeah, we can't get into that. That's only for chefs, right?
Just for the chefs, I'm afraid, yeah. For the chefs who come from all around the world. And then the awards itself on the 19th of June, where we'll be, I think, our biggest ever, with kind of around 1,200 people coming from all over the world for that event.
And you stream that, don't you?
Yeah, that will be streamed live on our Facebook page, the World's 50 Best Facebook page. So anyone that can't make it, we should follow us through our social media channels. And we can watch the whole event live, as well as keep up to date with all the announcements, the list, the different award winners, all the pictures from the night, videos from the night, and so forth.
Now, I have to ask, because it's always the elephant in the room, there have been some criticism about the awards and how they're handled, and I wanted to mention that and how you were attempting to address it. One is the obvious one is why a separate award for a woman and instead of having it, you know, women treated equally in the overall restaurant category, chef category, and then why there are some areas where the representation is very sparse, such as, I think I mentioned, what's the name of that place in Russia, the White Rabbit?
The White Rabbit.
Yeah, yep. It's the only one there, and the only one in Africa, I understand, is owned by a Frenchman.
That's the one that's in South Africa.
Yeah, and it's owned by a Frenchman.
Yeah, owned by a British-born
chef. So start with, what do you do about the women, female issue?
On the subject of White Rabbit, let's not pass by without saying that it's probably quite reasonable that there's only one decent restaurant in Russia.
Well, I don't know that.
I think it's an interesting area, it's certainly a growing area, the gastronomic scene in Russia.
It should
be. On the female representation issue, we continue to use the World's Best Female Chef Award as a means to provide a platform for successful females in this industry, in order to try and progress the discussion further around gender parity within the gastronomic world. We're aware that parity is a long way from being a reality yet. And until it's a reality, we want to use what opportunities we have on the platform that we can provide to help push towards that, towards a greater parity. At the moment, that's not the case, but our list is a list of restaurants, not of chefs. That's an important distinction. And we ask people to vote for the restaurant experiences based on the experiences they've had there, not based on the gender of the chef or the background of the chef. So it's vital. Of course, the chef, you know, influences that experience, but it's not necessarily a vote for them. It's a vote for the overall restaurant. Now, that restaurant list, indeed, is maybe dominated or have a high proportion of restaurants in, you know, Western Europe and the US, and not be as geographically diverse as some might wish it to be. However, it is increasingly diverse, and you know, we'd love to see it become even more diverse as the world of food in some ways gets smaller, in the sense that people are discovering new countries, new cuisines, or cuisines and countries that are new to them, at least, and they're making a name for themselves on the global map, whereas before it perhaps was more dominated by the traditional cuisines of Western Europe. So I think there is more diversity. It's a slow pace of change when you're dealing with the very top end of the restaurant world. But over the 16 years that we've been doing the World's 50 Best Restaurants, there's been enormous changes over that period, and I think there'll be further changes, which we hope will be positive in terms of both the gender issue as well as diversity in a wider sense.
Interestingly enough, Will, one of the things that certainly happens at the event, it happens for us because we get an opportunity to renew acquaintances with our friends around the world who are fine restaurants that we have had the opportunity to visit and record for our program. But the other thing that happens is a tremendous amount of interchange between the chefs themselves.
They love it, yes.
So for example, I just read just a few weeks ago that Lyle's, a fine restaurant in London, they have a guest, they have a guest chef series, and they bring in chefs from all over the world, including, interestingly enough, just recently, last year's best female chef, the one who was crowned in Melbourne, who's from a tiny little town in Croatia, cooking in the East End of London.
Well, you know, I think I've told you though that I think part of what's happened is with the Me Too movement, we had a memo of the Beard Awards to consider the character of the chefs that we were nominating or the restaurants that we were nominating, and it resulted in a much higher percentage of participation of females, and Food and Wine magazine just published their 10 best new chefs, and the most that had ever appeared on their cover would be two, and usually it was one or none, and this go around, it's all but four are women.
Yep. So that's an interesting area.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that maybe...
The Beard Awards are a little more chef-focused, and there's many more awards for chefs than in the World's 50 Best, which is a restaurants-focused awards. But similarly, although we didn't publicize our criteria, we made sure that our voters were aware, especially when they were voting for individuals, that they should take into account appropriate behavior in the industry. So, in a quieter way, we've done something similar. Yeah. We're confident that the list is, that the individual awards will reflect character as well as the popularity of the chefs among their peers. It's an area that we will have to look at for sure.
Well, one of the things that everyone's always very interested in is who votes. And I believe that there are sort of different categories, but can you talk to us a little bit about those guys?
Sure. Yeah, so we have over 1,000 voters around the world. They are chosen by our academy chairs, who are the head of the voting panel in each of 26 regions around the world. The voters are made up of three broad groups. The first group is chefs and restaurateurs themselves. They're all chefs and restaurateurs who travel internationally, who eat in plenty of good restaurants and can judge based on their expertise. We have a second group which is made up of food writers, restaurant critics, broadcasters, media in general related to the food and drink world. They have an expertise and ability to make a strong judgment based on the amount of effort they go to as part of their professional life. Then we have a third wider group we call well-traveled gourmets, who may be in the food and drink industry or may not. So they could be a sommelier or a wine importer, or they could just be in business but have a passion for food and eating in great restaurants and travel. Either as part of that passion or travel for their work and have the opportunity, therefore, to eat in a lot of restaurants internationally.
Yeah, now I know a lot of people
through that experience have developed some expertise. Yeah, a lot of people do that, increasingly so now as well, some of them using our list as their guideline.
Right. Is there any interface between you and Michelin? How do you interface with, you said Beards, it's more chef focused. And now there's this new group. What's it called? The World's, what's it called? Best Restaurant?
I don't even know the name.
Yeah, well, Joe Warwick and the guy who leads Jelena's.
Yeah, that's right.
That different?
There's plenty of room for different lists and competition if they're offering something different and something fresh that's not being offered already. We're focused on what we do, and we're very confident that the credibility we've built up over the last 16 years, the voting system, which is adjudicated by Deloitte independently to ensure its robustness and validity. That is, we're very confident that combination and the reach of 50 Best and the sense of community that you referred to earlier when the chefs get together all combines to make the world's 50 Best restaurants a very strong brand and a powerful platform for celebrating great restaurants and great chefs, as well as a platform for change and progression, moving things forward.
Well, you certainly are a great spokesperson for this group.
You're very kind.
Well, we've interviewed you a number of times, and I've thrown some would you call them, some oddball questions at you, and you always get a you catch and run, yeah.
No. I mean, look, and as I say, other awards and lists are fine. We would never say that people shouldn't do them. We're confident that ours is very strong, and we wouldn't want to disparage anyone else.
Yeah, how many places do you go a week?
Not as nearly as many as you think. Mm. we as the organisers involved in putting this whole thing together, but we don't make the judgment on the restaurants themselves. We don't vote. We organise the voting, but we it's not our job to choose the restaurants. Of course, we have to have a good knowledge of the restaurants involved. And we have to maintain a strong relationship with the chef community because, without the chefs attending our event, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't be as effective. But we're very confident we're going to have a huge proportion of the 50 chefs attending in Bilbao. Virtually all of them will be there.
Tell them, right?
We call first and tell them. They don't know what their ranking is, but they are aware confidentially that they're on the list. But no one else knows. None of the sponsors, none of the media has any idea of the list and the ranking until the actual award ceremony itself on June the 19th.
It's all very exciting for those who have not been, because we've been for years now, and I think we're going to pull out. We have the scarves you give the chefs. Some chefs gave us some scarves. Peter keeps wanting to wear them to the event. I think we're going to pull them out this year because we're going to have a grand time in the Basque Country.
It should be really fun. We're very excited about it. We're looking forward to a great program of events in a great part of the world with lots of. Lots of like-minded people coming together, so it should be great.
Well, Will, Drew, you are a trooper, and I thank you for taking the time to talk to us and look forward to seeing you at the World's 50 Best in June. Next month, that is. It's coming up very quickly.
Yeah, next month. Okay. Thank you. Well, thank you for your support. We much appreciate it, and it's always a pleasure talking to you.
You too. Thanks, Will. Bye-bye.
Okay, Will, so thanks for the story, and we'll see you in just a few weeks' time, and we'll be reporting, of course, from the scene, as we always do. And in the meantime, it's time to take a break, so don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.com. .net.
Welcome back. Now, Latin food, every so often people say, there's a surge in interest in Latin food. Well, I don't think Latin food goes out of style anytime. It's colorful, it's economically accessible, and in this book called Latin Table by Isabel Cruz, it's also easy to make. I mean, so easy to make, she says, and healthier.
Okay.
So let's hear for
Isabel Cruz of the about the Latin Table.
Isabel Cruz has a way of expressing the kind of warmth and family and camaraderie that one associates with Latin food. Her new book is The Latin Table, but you have other books as well. You're not exactly a newbie to this, Isabel. You also have three restaurants in San Diego, which is probably the sunniest place in the United States, right?
Which is what?
Probably the sunniest place in the United States.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, well, today it isn't, but yes.
Yeah. So, but your book is called Easy Flavorful Recipes from Mexico, Puerto Rico, and Beyond. And you do go beyond because, as you said, you grew up in Los Angeles, and so you experienced pretty much a melting pot of different food influences.
Yes, that's true. Different cultures as well.
Right. But, you know, this book is essentially Latin food, and you make an emphasis of the fact that it is easy, right?
Very, very easy. And, you know, that comes from my restaurant background. I wanted to make the recipes simple so I didn't have to be there all the time, because when I started them, I had two little boys, and I wanted to spend as much time with them as I could. So, I mean, that's where that all came from.
You have a fairly extensive pantry, though.
Yeah.
There's more.
Yeah,
more so than my Latin pantry. But you run everybody through that, and you talk about equipment and so forth. And then you do this whole lineup of, I would say that they're pretty typically... what would we call them? Well, they are Latin, aren't they? I mean, all of them, pretty much. Even though you might have a touch or two of some other cultures.
Right. Like I said, I love Asian food as well, so I do touch on that. One of my favorite recipes is the chili oil recipe, because there's so much you could do with a good chili oil. You can make other sauces with it. And even just, you know, plain simple chili oil, you could put it on rice and, you know, it changes it from, like, something simple to something yummy, you know, and it's easy, quick. I just really like them.
It's also such colorful food, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It is, and it's fresh food.
It is fresh.
You know, yes, they use a lot of... produce and simple ingredients, so it's anybody could do this, and you could do it anywhere. I made probably one of the best Latin dinners of my life in Italy with friends that had moved there, and when I went over there, I knew they were going to want me to cook Mexican because that's what they missed, and I thought, wow, where am I going to find things, but, you know, the Italian ingredients adapt really well. They have great tomatoes. They have good cheese. They have great... Yeah, so...
A lot of it comes from Latin America.
Right.
I mean, you didn't... Italy never had tomatoes until they discovered them in Central and South America.
Right.
So, where were you in Italy?
Where was I in Italy?
Yeah.
In Florence. I have friends that have a house outside of the main center of town.
In Fiesole?
Yeah, they moved from the States to Italy, and all their kids were born there, so when we go there, we go and we hang out with them, and we're cooking dinner all the time.
Oh, great.
At the house. Yeah, it's really fun.
Yeah. I went to school in Florence, so I love it. I know it, too.
It's an amazing city.
Yeah. Now, you have a number of very trend, or on-trend, I wouldn't say trendy, but on-trend. You've lightened up a lot of your recipes from you know, some of the Latin food can be heavy.
Yes. I've lightened it up and also just simplified the recipes.
Right.
So that you know, and again, that comes from having restaurants, you know, wanting to make the recipe so any of the cooks, you know, even the most unskilled or, you know, newer people can do them, you know, and it won't be, it'll be pretty good. They can't really mess them up that much.
So that translates into recipes that people can readily cook at home as well, right?
Exactly. And, you know, having kids and, you know, a business, you know, the same goes for wanting to cook at home more often. You know, it's hard when you come home from work tired and everybody's hungry, you know?
Right.
So I wanted to do recipes that, that are really family friendly, you know, and also, you know, for young people that are just starting to learn how to cook for themselves. This is a very simple book.
Now, you actually talk about, was it your 11-year-old was cooking from it or something?
Yes. I have an 11-year-old niece, and my boyfriend has a little girl that's 9, and they can follow these recipes. I mean, you know, I'm there, but they could make the flourless chocolate cake, and, you know, they've made some of the sauces, and they really want to get in there and cook when we're all in the kitchen. They really like it. So it really is a family friendly cookbook.
Well, I'm going to give this book to my our 11-year-old granddaughter who likes to cook, but I tested her out with a Jacques Pepin had a book he wrote with his granddaughter who was 12 or 13 or whatever, and he also did a TV show with her. But these recipes are not as simple as your book.
Yeah, my book is very simple.
I'm going to try this. I've never been able to, this very popular concept of cauliflower steaks. I've never been able to produce a roasted cauliflower that was anything but tough.
You know what? I think it's just having the right pan helps a lot.
Tell me about that.
Well, I love cast iron pans.
Yeah,
so
me too.
That's what I use. But honestly, at the restaurant, we use sheet pans to do the cauliflower, and it turns out pretty good on the sheet pans as well. But the cast iron is great because you want to get that nice caramelized sear on both sides and then have it cooked enough, but you don't want it to get mushy at all. So, you know what, it's just checking on it also, you know, checking on it. And, you know, all ovens are different. So it's just making sure that you don't overcook it, you don't burn it. But, you know, for me, once I get that sear on both sides, it's not that much longer to make sure that it's all done. So I think getting the nice sear first and then just checking it so that you don't overcook it.
Now, a friend, Alan Shire from Pizza Domenico in New Orleans.
Now.
Well, I guess he doesn't have.
No, he doesn't have that one anymore.
He cooked cauliflowers in the pizza oven.
Oh wow! Yeah, that would be great.
And worked extremely well.
It was good. Yeah.
He said it's unbelievable.
Oh yeah, that would be awesome.
It's unbelievable how many cauliflowers we go through in a week.
Oh wow! Yeah, I could imagine.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah. But I don't know how he got it that way with the temperature. It's a temperature issue. You get really high temperature in a pizza oven.
Now let's make sure that our listeners realize that. Although Isabel is modest, she's not entirely modest. So the favorite sauce in the whole book is called Isabel's sauce. tell us about Isabel's sauce.
It's one of the favorites. it's a really good all-purpose sauce, and it goes really well with the quick crema recipe. You know, a little bit of spicy red sauce. You know, it's almost, it could be like ketchup-y, you know, with the creamy sauces. They really marry well together.
Uh-huh. So what are some of your other favorites and go-to recipes?
You know what? I am big on sauces. So I like that
you
whole...
You have that whole section on it.
Sauces, yeah, and there's a lot of sauce recipes. Yes, because I think that you can eat very healthy if you have really good sauces on the side. You know, it takes, you know, if you have like, you know, just a piece of grilled fish or chicken and then some grain and some vegetable, adding the sauces to it makes it really enjoyable. So it doesn't feel like you're eating, you're necessarily eating healthy, or it doesn't feel like you're on a diet. So that's why I like the sauce section, because you could really dress up things. And also, like I said, the sauces, like the other recipes, are simple as well. So, I tried to make them so they're very interchangeable, because I like layering flavors as well. You know, maybe having two sauces and then also adding like a chunky salsa, you know, like a corn salsa or something with mango or pineapple and jicama. It just turns, like I said, a piece of grilled fish into, it takes it to a whole other level.
Ned, are these traditional Mexican sauces, or did you make them up?
I made them up. But, I mean, you do see... Yeah, I made them up. But you do see sauces like this, you know, through Latin America and in Mexico. I do think my recipes, like I said, they're just a little bit simpler. You know, they have less ingredients than traditional recipes, but I think they work. And they work for me and what I do in the restaurants, as well as for my family. You know, we get together every Sunday at my mom's house and we all cook together. My family, my brother's family, and my mom and
that's
my
really
aunt.
Nice.
Yeah, we should.
So, and it's fun, and we all, you know, everybody pitches in, everybody does something, and we enjoy it. And so, when we were doing the recipe testing for the book, we tested a lot of the recipes with everybody doing them, and it ended up being really fun.
Now, I keep trying to figure out what this thing is. There's no, it's like stacked. It looks like almost stacked pancakes with sauce on it. And it looks like, are those pepita nuts being, coating the top? What is that? It's a dessert.
Oh, wait, are you talking about the flourless chocolate cake?
That's probably what it is.
That's what it is, I guess.
It's the flourless chocolate cake with, salted pepitas on top.
There we
that's
go.
It.
Sounds great.
It sounds terrific.
Now,
that's the recipe the girls were making.
Let's not forget, by the way, what are the names of your restaurants? They're all three in San Diego?
Both of them are in San Diego. I have the Coffee Cup Cafe in La Jolla and Isabel's Cantina in Pacific Beach.
Okay. Just the two.
The two, yeah. We have a restaurant in Oregon.
Okay. Tell us about the farm.
I have a
farm in Oregon with my ex-husband.
Uh-huh.
And the Northwest is really beautiful.
Oh yeah,
really
I've always wanted to live there. I mean, we love Oregon actually.
Yeah, and the food is amazing there.
Uh-huh.
Really, really, really great restaurants,
yeah.
Great chefs, great restaurants.
Yeah, they have a wonderful farmer's market there on Saturday.
Oh, my God, isn't it?
Isn't it, yeah.
Portland, yes.
But
by the college. Oh, it's amazing, isn't it? It's one of the best I've been to, I think.
But I also remember I was in San Diego once, and there's a hotel, a really nice hotel near the baseball stadium. I can't remember what it's called. It's on like 7th Street or something like that.
Yes.
And
there's a lot of great hotels down there.
And I talked to the chef, and the chef said the reason that he took the job was the farmer's market in San Diego.
There's some really great ones in San Diego as well.
He said he could...
I mean, there really are some great ones. The ones in Oregon are just, you know, it's, they're just,
well,
really good. That one's amazing.
I won't forget, probably the most astounding hotel experience I ever had was we were on a fam tour, and the people that we were hosting us booked us into this hotel, and we went into this hotel, and every room was equipped with a condom and earplugs.
Yeah.
I don't think we even stayed 24 hours in that hotel. It was
we didn't.
It was also very worn and dirty.
We stayed less than 8 hours.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
I can't remember the name of it.
But it was that, what was it, Wild About something or other? Wild About Game.
It was on the wrong side of Portland.
That's so funny.
Yeah. But what do you do on your farm? Do you grow things?
Organic produce.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I mean, when I'm there, we're cooking all the time and picking things out in the fields, and it's just, you know, it's so different from San Diego. You know, in San Diego, you don't have, you know, all the giant trees and waterfalls and all the things that Oregon is famous for. So it's just, I love both places equally. You know, they're just different. You know, San Diego is beaches and palm trees, and Oregon is mountains and waterfalls and amazing greenery. So it's really fun going back and forth between both of them.
Right. Drive or fly? Fly.
Fly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a hard drive. It's far.
Yeah, it is. San Diego's hard to get any place from, I think.
Right, it is. And the flights are easy, so.
Well, anyhow, listeners, you need to get this book if you like colorful, flavorful, warm and tasty food that is simple enough that you can actually cook it yourself and quickly. So Isabel Cruz, it's wonderful meeting you, and your book, The Latin Table, good luck with that, good luck with your farm,
thank
good luck
you
with your
so
restaurant.
Much for having me. You've been great.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, so here's the mystery, listeners. Closing out today's program, we have... Who is it from Goodnow?
Goodnow Farms.
Goodnow Farms.
Which is...
And why does it fit into today's program? Well, here's the most bizarre thing. The founders of Goodnow Chocolates spent much of their careers in Los Angeles, and one of their good friends was Isabel Cruz. You're puzzling. That was the guest we just had on the program, remember?
Right. No. I just thought it was...
You're worrying about
it's
something.
It's a small world, is
that
what
it
thinking.
Is? Okay.
The culinary scene is a small world.
Yep, right. So anyway, people were doing something else altogether, decided they fell in love with making chocolate for themselves. They felt they could really do a good job of it. So... Instead of doing it in Los Angeles, they decided to move back to the Northeast where they had started their careers and founded Goodnow Chocolates, and it's a really interesting story. And
I have a little bit of that chocolate every single day for medicinal
purposes
health reasons.
Only, right?
Right.
It's
healthy.
It's like that McGay sap.
Yeah, I also have a teaspoon of McGay sap, or whatever it's called.
Anyway, let's go back to Goodnow Chocolates.
We're going to be talking about award-winning chocolate, and this is a guy after my own heart here, Tom Rogan, who is
Goodnow Farms, and he's half of the team. Monica is the other half, who we don't have on the phone, but two of them together started this venture producing, it's award-winning all over the place, but I'm telling you, it knocks your socks off because I've been eating it regularly. Congratulations on getting this down pat. And your idea, let's start at the beginning. What did you do before?
So before Monica and I started making chocolate, we were both living in Los Angeles. I was making television shows, and Monica was doing real estate development.
I see. Huh. And you were...
Natural move. Everybody who does that goes on to make chocolate.
Oh, yeah, TV to chocolate. Totally natural.
But what gave you the idea? Because the people that we interview a lot of chocolatiers, and I'll tell you, one's more interesting than the next. I don't know what it is about the process, but it tracks.
I was going to say one's wackier than the next, but present company accepted, of course.
Of course. Yeah, well, this will be the first one that's going to be less interesting than the previous one. So, we came across Kraft Chocolate about 10 years ago. We were, like I said, living in Los Angeles. We went to a store that happened to have some chocolate. They weren't even a chocolate store. They were actually a furniture shop. But in the back of the store were some chocolate bars, and it turns out the couple that owned the store made them. And we started talking to them about what that even meant, because we never even realized that was possible. And then when we tasted them, it just sort of opened our eyes to what chocolate could be. And it's very different than anything we'd had before. So that's how the interest in it started, and then our interest in making chocolate came from the fact that that store was very far away from our house. So we drive, in Los Angeles, it takes an hour to get anywhere, so it's, you know, 2-hour round trip to get chocolate. Got a little crazy, so one day we're like, you know, they're making it, so, you know, how hard could it be for us to make it? Little did we realize, it's kind of hard. I mean, the very basic, we started out, like everybody else did, just making it in our home kitchen, and it was, you know, roasting them in our oven and using a blade coffee grinder to mix the sugar in the nibs, and, you know, hair dryer to winnow. So, you know, very basic setup. Yeah, that's the easiest way to make it at home. And then that just started to open up our eyes about the possibilities. Where do you get your beans from? Because that has a big effect on flavor. And then how are those farmers compensated? And that just started us on the journey of, wow, if we want to do this and make this more often and make it higher quality, what do we need to do?
Well, cacao has such a long history. I mean, it's the Aztec chieftains used to get their strength from it, right?
Yeah, Montezuma reportedly drank like dozens and dozens of cups a day. So that's how Cortez, who was the first explorer to bring cacao back to Europe, to Spain, first came across it in Montezuma's court.
But, you know, it was mainly drinking chocolate. It was a drink.
Yes.
They didn't make it into candy or bars until, when was it?
Late 1800s, okay. Really, when it was something that was edible. It was conched. You know, once Rudolf Lindt invented the conch, that sort of changed the way that bar chocolate was perceived, for good reason.
You're going to have to explain conching to our listeners.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, so I can do it, but it won't be very lucid.
conching is the mythology behind how the conch was invented is that Rudolf Lindt was testing a bunch of equipment and chocolate making equipment. He left this piece of equipment on over the weekend, and when he came by accident, and when he came in on Monday, he tasted it and realized, wow, this is amazing chocolate. So what the conch does is it agitates the chocolate, and it allows the cocoa butter to really coat the solid cocoa particles that are in the chocolate. It makes it smooth. It also aerates the chocolate. There's certain volatiles that come off, acids in particular, that take out some of the bite. Some people say bitterness. I try to avoid the word bitterness because I think what people perceive as bitterness in mass market dark chocolate isn't the chocolate, it's the other stuff they're adding to it. But it just made it a much more pleasant.
Yeah, I fight with people
experience.
About that all the time, by the way. These people who insist on milk chocolate, which I don't like at all, really.
That's right, well, it all tastes the same. It tastes like milk. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now, do the cocoa butter thing, because I remain puzzled about exactly where that sort of fits in.
So, cocoa butter, cacao beans naturally are about 50% fat in the form of cocoa butter.
Okay.
So when you, that's why when you grind the cacao beans or the nibs of the bean, you get a liquid. It's kind of like if you crush peanuts, you get peanut butter.
Right.
So that fat allows it to become liquid. And that's actually an interesting point you bring up about the cocoa butter, because that's why it melts in your mouth. That's what, when you're tempering chocolate, you're creating crystals in the cocoa butter that's allowing it to have that snap and is slightly raising the melting point so you can hold it in your hand long enough to eat it. And also, that separates us somewhat from a lot of the other craft chocolate makers in the country in that we press our own cocoa butter. So what that means is if you're buying a commercial chocolate bar, mass market chocolate bar, and you see cocoa butter as an ingredient, the vast majority of the time, that's bulk deodorized cocoa butter that they're buying, and that's diluting the flavor of the beans that you're using to make the chocolate, or it's adding its own off flavors.
Right.
So to avoid doing that, we take the same beans that we're roasting that week, and we make a special batch of cacao liquor, cocoa liquor, and then we press that under really high pressure. You can separate the cocoa butter from the cocoa solids. The cocoa solids later become cacao powder. And then we take that additional cocoa butter we pressed from those beans and put it into our batch of chocolate. So it gives our chocolate a much creamier mouthfeel, helps translate the flavors to your tongue a little faster. It's just something we really enjoy from a flavor and consistency standpoint.
But when you on the front of the bar I'm looking at is an Esmeralda's bar.
Mm-hmm.
It says 70% cacao, premium dark chocolate. Now, what does that mean? What does that mean?
So cacao percentage is basically the percentage of items that came from the cacao bean. So that includes both cocoa solids and cocoa butter. So that's why the percentage isn't really a good indication of how that bar is going to taste, because you can have a bar that's 70% cacao, 30% cocoa butter, and 70% cacao solids. It tastes very different than a bar that was, say, 90% cacao solids and 10% cocoa butter. So those two things together equal your cacao percentage, and you subtract whatever else you're adding to that bar,
yeah,
whether it's sugar or almonds or whatever, that takes away from your cacao percentage. So with our bars, the plain bars, where it's just the cacao and the sugar, a 70% cacao bar means 70% of that bar is cocoa.
Yes. How do you do that?
It's a very big challenge. I mean, that's one of the most difficult hurdles that's facing craft chocolate makers today, is this is a very labor-intensive process. You know, the scale that we're doing, you don't really have automation, so all of it's done by hand, all the way through the wrapping of the bars, for the most part. And it just takes a lot of time, and it really requires efficiency, you know, really making it something that, requires, even though it's very labor intensive, how do you make it as efficient as possible so that the numbers work? And for us, that's even more difficult because the process of pressing cocoa butter adds a lot of time and a lot of cost. You know, we'll use 30% of the beans, 30% more beans in a bar than other makers, because we need those beans to press the cocoa butter. That's why most makers don't do it. It's just a lot more expensive.
Yeah, there's one chocolatier who actually only uses the antique equipment, too. I can't remember which one he is. Do you know him?
Yeah, well, a lot of people take old machines and refurbish them.
Yeah, that's what this guy does.
Yeah. I mean, because they work very well, and it's also, there's, for our scale, nowadays, everything that's mechanized is industrial scale to the size of Hershey's. You're talking about the size of a school bus. So it's possible to get these older machines that were made for a smaller industrial scale. It kind of works within the size of the chocolate makers that we are, which is this odd middle ground that didn't really exist until 10 years ago or so. So the machines that we're using are all very new and are, you know, constantly in a state of development.
Well, now you do only bars, right?
Just bars.
And it's very important for you in your sourcing that you go for the best beans in different geographical locations and yep. then put every bit of effort, your material says, into showcasing the flavor profile of that particular bean. Is that the mission of Goodnow Farms chocolate?
Yeah, I mean, that's the primary reason we're doing this. And I should explain for people who might not know what single origin is, that means that we go to one location or one area and we get the beans from that location and use only those beans in a bar. And the reason is that different cacao, kind of like different wine grapes or different coffee beans, have different flavors.
How different is it, I'm wondering, you know?
Well, if you taste it, it's radically different. I mean, radically different in flavor, and sometimes even in color. If you look at our bars next to each other, even the ones that are all 77%, mm-hmm. same cacao percentage, some of them are completely different colors than the others. And that's a visual representation of the genetic differences, where most of the differences are in taste.
Well, so, how do you find these things? Do you actually go into the field and talk to the growers, don't you?
Well, yeah, because we believe early on when we were starting out, we really wanted to make sure we were finding great cacao, and we quickly realized to get really great stuff and to get it consistently, we needed to know what was happening on the ground. So we spent many years doing sourcing trips down to Central America, which is the main place we started sourcing from. We've also been, you know, obviously, Mexico, South America, because we needed to know what the farmers were doing, how they were, you know, propagating and harvesting the cacao, how they were fermenting and drying it, because the fermentation and the drying have a huge impact on flavor. And, you know, you can buy beans, you can go online, buy a bunch of beans off the shelf and get some great beans, but there's no guarantee that the next time you order those, it's going to be the same quality,
thing,
the
yeah,
same flavor.
Consistency.
So we wanted to know the farmers, and in addition to the quality, we also wanted to make sure that the way they were farming was sustainable, that they were exercising fair labor practices and paying their workers a fair wage and all that kind of stuff. So we felt like being on the ground was important for a number of different reasons.
And you needed, in a way, you needed to know how the chocolate had been handled, right? All the way through from when it was picked off a tree.
Yes, because all that has a huge impact on flavor. Every step of that process, we wanted to make sure that that was being done in a way that was going to not only allow for high quality, but for consistently high quality. And to that end, like, we found some great cacao in a village in Guatemala. We work with a great group called Cacao Vera Paz, who is going around to that region and helping educate the communities on how to ferment and dry their own cacao to a high standard. And this one village had great cacao, but their fermentation facility was not in great shape.
Yeah, people don't even think about fermentation with chocolate, but that's it.
You can take a great bean, the best bean in the world, and you can ferment it badly and ruin it. So it's very easy to mess that up. So we ended up talking to the villagers and working with Cacao Vera Paz, and we ended up funding the construction of a new fermentation and drying facility for that village. So that was able to allow them to do higher quality fermentations more consistently and more beans. They could sell it to more people and, you know, bring in more revenue to the village.
Now, are they exclusive with you? I mean, the Esmeraldas, for example, do they only sell beans to you?
No, for the most part, most craft chocolate makers are too small to do an exclusive deal with a producer. And the other thing is, it's not necessarily in the producer's best interest. We wouldn't ask for exclusivity because, you know, they need to protect themselves. They need to have many different buyers and have the opportunity to grow, because who knows, you know, a chocolate maker could end up going out of business or could, you know, order a lot less beans 1 year. So it's better for them to have more people buying their beans.
No, but you're really into community involvement with these things. I mean, you remind me a little of Sean Eskenazi, who's really, he's very involved in the house. And he even puts the photographs of the growers on some of his bars.
Yeah, I think you'll find that the majority, I would even go so far as to say the vast majority of craft chocolate makers out there are very involved with the farmers at origin for many different reasons, and part of it is I think we all agree there needs to be changes in the way that chocolate is sourced, and we want to be a part of that positive change.
Now, you keep winning all these awards, and I said to you before, I don't understand why you didn't win a Sophia from the Specialty Food Association because it's the best chocolate that they had there.
Well, you know, it's all relative, and you know, we're just happy to be recognized by you know, we won a good food award, which is great, yeah, and then the Northwest Chocolate Festival, we won a silver there, which was which was also great, and I am happy to announce we just found out we just won 6 Academy of Chocolate Awards, which is very exciting. So it's nice to get the recognition, and I think that it is also helpful in raising awareness. The biggest thing is, one of our biggest challenges, every craft chocolate maker's challenge, is educating people about what this chocolate is and why it's special and why you're paying more for it than you would for other bars. And I think awards like this help to spread that message, which is, you know, it's a really important thing to get out there.
Now, on the back of this Esmeralda's Bean bar, which is the first one we ate, it has a batch number 1040. Does that mean exactly that it's the 1040th bar you've created?
Yes, except subtract 1,000.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, we started, and that's not a one-to-one. We started in November 2016. Is when we first began selling our bars as Goodenough Farms chocolate on the scale that we are now. Before that, we were making very small batches, and it was a whole different process. So once we started doing this in our new facility with our current lineup of beans, we started our batch numbers fresh. So it's been 40 batches since we started at the end of 2016.
Yeah, wow. Our cousin's wife started a magazine, and her first issue was zero.
Zero, yeah. No, I also came from the TV world. Every episode, your first episode's not never episode one; it's episode 101. So that was just part of what was ingrained in me.
Just out of curiosity, how did you get from Los Angeles to Boston?
Well, I'm from Western Massachusetts originally, okay, and I went to school at Emerson College, which is in Boston. But then I went out to L.A. for 23 years, and we just came back in 2015.
And what did you do in television? I mean,
I had a production company. We did a lot of shows for cable networks like Discovery Channel, Food Network. We did like Ace of Cakes on Food Network.
Oh, boy.
We won an Emmy Award for a show called Best Thing I Ever Made on Food Network. So a lot of food programming. I have a couple of James Beard Award nominations on my wall, and people are like, oh, wow, you've won a James Beard for your chocolate? I was like, no. That was for TV. So just nominated. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting, yeah. Who do you sell to? I mean, what is your target market, and how does one acquire your chocolate? I mean, I know one place, because my friend Amy is at Rosenfield is opening, is buying your chocolate, and she's
right.
Going to have it in Mon Ami chocolate,
yep,
her shop. So you must be doing shops as well, retail. I mean,
yeah,
wholesale
we do.
To shops.
Yeah, most of our sales are wholesale to gourmet stores, specialty shops, you know, specialty food, wine, cheese, those kind of places. We're also in a number of Whole Foods here in the Northeast. And we're in a bunch of stores like that all over the country, Los Angeles, Seattle, San Francisco, Chicago. So those kind of stores where people have sort of understanding and appreciation for the different flavors, we tend to do really well in.
Well, I'm so pleased that you, as far as I can tell, you haven't been seduced into the wacky flavors.
Well, I think, you know, anything that floats your boat, like no matter how crazy the flavor is, like if that's something you're interested in, go for it. You know, I mean, that's something that we're just doing stuff that we're passionate about. Like we're working on a couple different new bars now, including I love whiskey, so we're working on a whiskey bar, and just a lot of really cool stuff, you know, coming down the
road. What kind of whiskey are you using?
That is a trade secret until it comes out.
Yeah, they're doing that with ice cream a lot, too, which I'm not sure I understand that, but anyhow.
Well, listen, what's the website, and is there a store finder on the website?
Yeah, so it's goodnowfarms.com, and we sell all of our bars on the website and also our hot cocoa mix. So because we press our own cocoa butter, we also have 100% cacao powder, which we then add We then combine with sugar to make a hot cocoa mix.
Yeah, we have some of that, but I haven't tried it yet. I bet it's good.
Yeah, well, it's like the bars. Like, they have very distinct flavors. So we use single origin hot cocoa, and you can taste the different flavors. Because we don't, unlike most hot cocoa out there, we don't alkalize. It's just, you know, fresh pressed, and then we grind it and put it in the bags. And it's true to the flavor of the bean.
And don't put any marshmallows in it.
No, look, whatever you want to add to. This is really about people enjoying. Like, that's one of the reasons, if you notice, like, our bar wrapper and
our logo. The packaging is wonderful, yeah.
We wanted to have a nice, you know, sort of a whimsical sense. Not, I think people get intimidated by craft chocolate sometimes and think, oh, if I'm not tasting these 10 different flavors that are supposedly in here, then, you know, it's not meant for me. So we wanted to make sure people understood, like, it's whatever you like. If you like it, it's fine, you know. So do whatever. Add marshmallows, add fluff. I don't care. If you like it, great. Go for it.
And if you want to put some bourbon in your cocoa, that would be a great idea.
Well, that goes without saying, yeah. That's part of the recipe.
Well, thank you so much, Tom, for joining us. And
it's Goodmell Farms chocolate, and it's a real exposure to the possibilities of the bean to bar chocolate cacao. I love talking to you, and it's very good meeting you. And I wish you continued success. And hello to Monica, please, for us.
Absolutely. I really appreciate you guys taking the time, and thanks for supporting Kraft Chocolate.
Okay, listeners, so that, as they say, is a wrap. Until the same time, same place next week, when we hope you'll join us again. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.